From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, French film star Catherine Deneuve talks about her career. She starred in Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Repulsion, Belle du Jour, Indochine, and now the new film Thieves. Also today, the politics of taxes and why tax cuts don't often deliver the relief they promise to the middle class. We talk with Philadelphia Inquirer investigative reporters Donald Barlett and James Steele. They wrote the newspaper series America, Who Stole the Dream, which will be published in book form this month. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at the new season for The X-Files and the new show Millennium. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Larry Matthews. Polish critics are welcoming the Nobel Prize for Literature that's gone to Polish poet Wisława Szymborski. In announcing the award, the Nobel Prize Committee praised the 73-year-old poet's ironic precision. The BBC's Sancha Berg has more from Warsaw.
Critics describe Wisława Szymborska as Poland's greatest living woman poet. Now 73, she published her first poems 40 years ago. Commentators say the Nobel Prize is welcome, though overdue, recognition. One of her close friends, another poet, Ewa Lipska, said it shows that Polish poetry is well recognized around the world and that it has a universal appeal. Those who know her say Wisława Szymborska is modest in person as in her poetry. Her writing focuses on personal, small-scale subjects. One critic described it as private, not public, poetry. Observers say Wisława Szymborska belongs to the greatest generation of Polish poets. One of her contemporaries, Czesław Miłosz, won the Nobel Prize for Literature 16 years ago. Now he is known worldwide. Supporters of Mrs. Szymborska say she's gaining recognition abroad, and they hope she'll follow suit.
The BBC's Sancha Berg. Palestinian demonstrators threw stones at Israeli soldiers and burned an American flag today during demonstrations on the West Bank. They were reacting to the failure of the Washington summit to produce a date for Israel to pull its troops out of Hebron and for an Israeli agreement to close a tourist tunnel near a Muslim holy site in Jerusalem. Israeli troops are on alert throughout the West Bank. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government is praising the summit, in which Israel and the Palestinians have agreed to resume peace talks Sunday at a border crossing between Israel and Gaza. Russian President Boris Yeltsin tried to reassure his citizens today in a nationwide radio address. Yeltsin made the broadcast from a hospital where he's awaiting heart surgery. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Moscow.
In the first of what aides say will be regular radio addresses, Yeltsin assured Russians that, in his words, "I am in touch with what's going on in the country. I am helped by a strong team of professionals." Yeltsin, who's been hospitalized nearly 3 weeks, is due to undergo heart bypass surgery in November or December. But today he fought back against critics who've accused him of being unfit to govern. "I said before the elections and repeat now," said Yeltsin, "don't rush to change the portraits. The country has a president and an active president at that." Yeltsin also expressed full support for his security chief, Alexander Lebed, and Lebed's peace deal in Chechnya. Until today, Yeltsin had voiced only lukewarm support for Lebed. The two men also met today at Yeltsin's hospital, their first meeting since Lebed negotiated his peace deal last month. This is Andy Bowers in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 13.42 at 5920.55 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Auto workers in Canada are on strike against General Motors. 15,000 Canadian Auto Workers Union members set up picket lines outside GM plants in Ontario and Quebec just after midnight in a dispute over outsourcing the use of cheaper outside suppliers, many of them non-union. The strike could affect General Motors plants in the United States, which use parts made in Canada. U.S. plants could be forced to shut down if the Canadian strike lasts longer than 1 week. The union says it has a war chest of $37 million, enough to cover a strike for 12 weeks. Argo Alaska has plans for a major new oil development on Alaska's North Slope. As Ellen Lockyer of Alaska Public Radio Network reports, the oil company wants to begin construction late next year at its Alpine field.
The new Alpine field, located more than 30 miles from currently developed oil fields, is thought to contain around 300 million barrels of oil. ARCO owns the fields jointly with two partner companies. Spokesman Ronnie Chapel says ARCO first drilled a discovery well at the site 2 years ago, but did not announce its find until the field's potential was assured. The Alpine field is expected to yield enough crude oil to impact domestic production into the next century. ARCO plans initial production of 30,000 barrels of oil a day by the year 2000. The development is significant because it is the first oil project on Native Corporation-owned land in the past 25 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Alaska.
The government is unveiling a plan to help newlyweds buy their first homes. The Department of Housing and Urban Development's plan allows newlyweds to set up a bridal registry account for family and friends to contribute toward a down payment for a home. Banks will work with the Federal Housing Administration to set up interest-bearing accounts. I'm Larry Matthews, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Catherine Deneuve, is not only an actress, she's an icon. She's been called one of the most remarkably beautiful actresses of our time. She started her career in the early 60s and soon won international recognition for her performances in Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Belle du Jour, and Repulsion. More recently, she starred in The Last Metro, Indochine, which won her the Best Actress Award in France, and Ma Saison Préférée, directed by André Téchiné. Téchiné also directed her new film, Thieves, Les Voleurs. Thieves will be shown this weekend at the New York Film Festival and will open in theaters throughout the states in December. The film is an erotic, psychological thriller about a detective investigating the murder of his brother. The detective becomes lovers with a thief, a young woman who worked with the brother, but this woman has another lover, a philosophy professor, played by Catherine Deneuve. I asked Deneuve what was new for her in this role.
To be in love with a woman, to be in love with a woman. It's very clear in the film that Marie, the character I play, is a woman who has married and has children. And she meets that girl and she falls in love with her. That's the first experience. That was something I was, you know, not too familiar with. But the way it's written in the film is something very, very subtle, and actually I didn't find any difference to feeling in love with a girl or with a boy, because the way she loves that girl is a very total and very affectionate, you know, even if it's very physical as well, not in the film, but what you feel the relation between the two is physical as well. I mean, the kind of relation she has with that young student is a very generous love, and actually so generous that at the end they will part because they cannot really live together. It's not something that is supposed to happen. And Mary, my character, is a woman who lacks the natural aggressivity to live in any world today anyway. So she's going to give up almost everything because she has nothing to fight for.
I think a lot of American actors and actresses are afraid to take on the roles of gays or lesbians in movies.
I can understand.
Did you have any concerns?
No, but I'm not American.
Do you think it's different in France than in America?
Yes, very.
What's the difference?
I think it's a question of religion and education. I think in America, people allow themselves a lot of things, but in the same time, they're very, I don't know how you say, pudibond. I mean,
Then America's more moralistic?
Yes, very much on private life and sexual life. I mean, it's incredible to see to which level can a private life of someone public to bring him and destroy his life. I think that's something that cannot happen in Europe.
So in Europe, the personal life and the life on screen are considered more separate?
Much more. But even, you know, in a lot of things in politics, I don't think, for example, when our president, you know, François Mitterrand, got known for having a daughter with out of marriage, you know, with another woman that he had been living with for over 20 years. And that's quite recent, you know, it was in the last few years that we heard and we learned about that officially in the magazines. Even if some people were shocked, you know, I don't think people were so shocked. And it was admitted. I think here in America, he would have had to dismiss to, you know, to quit politics. It would have been a scandal.
Well, you've had two children out of wedlock, each with other people in the film world. And I'm wondering, I mean, were the French ever moralistic about that?
As far as I'm concerned, no. No, you can have a public life and have a private life. It's something that's very possible in Europe. I mean, when you are interviewed, you know, you're not supposed. There is a very strong law in France also to protect private life in public matters. You are not supposed to be taken picture of or interviewed without your consentment, or even taken in picture without your consentment and then published, printed in magazines. That's a very strong law, and you can really fight. Even sue magazines that would do that. I don't think there is anything like that in America. Which means you have to be very careful all the time, which means also, I suppose, you have to lie, which is something I would hate to have to do for as far as my private life is concerned.
That's an interesting point. You're saying that in America, people in public life are forced to lie because the
yes.
truth would be unacceptable.
Absolutely. On private life, yes. On private matters, yes.
Catherine Deneuve is my guest, and she stars in the new film Les Voleurs, Thieves. Your parents, I believe both of them were actors.
Yes.
What kind of work did they do?
My mother was on stage in a public theater very, very young. She was 5 when she went on stage. And she went on doing stage and dubbing films, American films in France. Even a few years after she had children, we were 4 girls in my family. And my father was a stage actor as well.
Now, when you started acting as a teenager, you used your mother's name, Deneuve. Why did you use her name instead of your father's name?
Because I had my sister, who was an actress before me, and actually that's how I started to do films, because I played her sister in a film during the holidays while I was at school, and that's why my parents allowed me to do that film. But my sister was an actress before, and she kept her name, which was, you know, normal, and I never thought anywhere that it would last. I was not sure I was going to go on doing films, so I didn't really care, and I didn't want really to find another name, so I took my mother's name for that reason.
So, 'cause your sister was using your father's name, the family name?
Yeah, family name, yes.
So you wanted to have a different name from her?
Well, I think it would have been difficult to be both, you know. Maybe even today, yes, I regret that. Today I regret, because I lost my sister, and we were only 4 girls, so my family name is going to go, it's finished. And but I think at the time it seemed difficult to be too, you know, we were so close in age and everything that to have the same name would be some sort of confusion.
You said it wasn't until Umbrellas of Cherbourg in 1964 that you started taking acting seriously. What was it about that film that made you serious about acting?
It's not about the film, it's about the director.
Mm-hmm. Because Jacques Demy.
Jacques Demy, yes, he's a very, it was a very important director, and it was very important for me to meet someone like that so young. He gave me confidence, and he sort of made me look at things in a different way. I mean, I had done very few films before to meet him, and I couldn't imagine, you know, it could be like that. And it was really like a revelation. It was something I would have never think of. And after that, it really was very different for me.
Could you say what it was about his approach to making movies that you found so new and exciting and different?
I suppose first it's because his personality, you know, and his way of seeing films and directing and doing very long shots, very long traveling, and that was something that I was not used to, you know. And also the sense he had of color and using actors, and he was talking, you know, about what he was doing. That's something he wanted to share with us. And he was he had a lot of confidence in me, which I didn't have. And that really helped me a lot. I realized that if a director really wants you and is very strong and has a good personality and is very positive, it can bring you, to me it was really like an incredible discovery.
I love this film. It was restored and recently re-released.
Yes,
it's a
beautiful,
wonderful film.
Beautiful new copy.
Now, all the dialogue is sung in the movie, and all the actors' voices are dubbed by professional singers. When did you find out that you weren't going to be using your own voice in the movie?
From the beginning, because it was written, you know, as an opera, And no way that the music of Michel Legrand could be sung by an actor that would work for a few months. And it was already a very difficult work to have to learn by heart completely the film, so we could shoot the film and be completely lip-sync. That was very difficult. And that was enough of a difficulty for two young actors like me and Nino Castelnuovo, my partner.
I'm thinking of how hard it must be to give such a convincing performance when one of your greatest tools, your voice, can't be used.
Yes, but, you know, it was a musical. So when you have to do it, and first I was, you know, I was not even 20 years old, so I didn't really realize that. I had very little experience. And when I had to learn the music with the words, you know, I was so taken by the music. And even when you have to shoot, you have to really sing loud. You cannot just open your mouth, you know, as if you were just, you know, trying to be just in lip sync. I mean, you really have to sing. It's not your voice that you hear, but I remember I had the impression that I was really singing. And I thought, you know, that doing a film, you have to do it for the best. And the fact it was not me, but a singer, seemed normal to have a professional for the... It's a frustration afterwards, a long time afterwards. But when I did it and when we did the film, it was absolutely fine for me. And I didn't think, you know, that what a shame is not going to be my voice and I feel so frustrated, or I didn't feel like that at all. Maybe today, yes, I wouldn't do it because I have the impression that my voice is more known because I've been doing many films and people know my voice. But at the time, you know, it was to me a normal thing, you know, to have a professional singer. And anyway, it's very, very difficult to sing Michel Legrand. Very difficult.
I just want to ask you one question about the ending. This is a movie about a young couple who are deeply in love, but they're separated when he's sent off to the military. And because then she ends up being pregnant, and because she doesn't hear from him a lot, she assumes he's left her, and she ends up marrying somebody else. He comes back, is heartbroken, and later marries somebody else. What do you think of the ending? Do you think that they're better off with the people who they married than with each other?
I don't know. That's impossible to know. What I can think of, it's a very sad ending for me because it's a very... obviously, they seem to be, you know, happy, I don't know, but they seem to be fine, you know, with the lives they have. But when you've seen the film, and for the audience, I suppose, to the desire, you know, to get those two people together again, because it was such a strong and such an emotional love story that you feel like crying, because that's life, you know. It's very unfair. Actually, the film is not it's not like a fairy tale like some people said, you know, because she's pregnant, her mother pushes her to marry another man because she's pregnant, and it's no question she's not going to keep the child, and no question that she's going to be by herself. And her mother pushes her in the arm of someone very fine, quite rich, you know. I mean, sort of conventional thing that make me cry. Even today.
Catherine Deneuve is my guest, and she's starring in the new movie, Thieves. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Catherine Deneuve. Her new film, Thieves, will be shown this weekend at the New York Film Festival. In 1967, you made Belle du Jour, directed by Louis Buñuel. Now, this movie has also recently been restored. It's an interesting contrast to Umbrellas of Cherbourg. In Umbrellas, you played somebody very young and very naive. In Belle du Jour, you're a young married woman, but
you... But quite naive as well.
Okay, but naive in a different way. Because,
yes, yeah. But naive in a way.
Yeah, you can't be sexually satisfied within the marriage, so you become a prostitute at a very high-priced brothel.
Call girl, yes.
Yeah, and you're there during the day, and your husband doesn't know about it. Mm-hmm. And the movie combines the reality of your married life, the brothel life, with all of these fantasy mm-hmm. Scenes. What was Buñuel's approach to directing you in this role?
Very little. Very, very little. The script was so, you know, really very heavy on the matter. So, and Buñuel didn't like much to give psychological explanations to actors. I remember to have had difficulties, you know, sometimes, because also the producer were very strong and Buñuel was in Paris living in a hotel. And I wouldn't see him much, you know, outside of work. And he wouldn't let me go and see the rushers, the dailies, you know. It was a little, sometimes it has been difficult. It was a difficult shooting sometimes. My remember of him is much better when we did Tristana, you know, 2 years later mm-hmm. in Spain, because that was a much better experience for me as an actress with him. But Belle de Jour was a difficult subject anyway to do.
Yes, well, I'm wondering if in Belle de Jour, if the woman's sexual fantasies of humiliation made any sense to you.
Yes, it makes sense because fantasies are made, you know, to it's like a phantasm. You're supposed to, you imagine yourself in a situation that you might never leave, but that you need because it gives you some excitement or some, and actually in Belle de Jour, they're very, all the situation are very classical situation that men and women think of, you know, sometimes in a love affair. It's something very, and when I saw Belle de Jour again, that I hadn't seen it for a very, very long time. I saw it again then in New York in that very beautiful restored copy in New York. And I was quite surprised to see the sort of humor, you know, also that there was in the film, which I didn't feel that much at the time when I did the film. Maybe when I saw the film, but when I did the film, I didn't feel that much.
Now, the film critic David Thompson wrote this about you. He wrote, "Deneuve is a fantastic actress, her beauty a receptacle for any imagination, perhaps the greatest cool blonde, forever hinting at intimations of depravity." And what's your reaction to that?
I like that. I think it's better than any kind of, you know, nicer compliment about being. I think it's very intriguing, you know, to imagine someone being such a, like a deep volcano. You know, you don't know how far down, you know, you can fall. But in the same time, officially, when you look at that person, she seems, you know, very straightforward. Very, I find it very intriguing.
Yes,
I would like to meet the person he's talking about.
You feel very far from that, as Catherine Deneuve.
Well, I have the impression he's talking, of course, about someone else, you know, something between me, but mostly something about the character. And it's one of the films I've done, Belle de Jour, that followed me more than anything during all my life, because I did Belle de Jour in 69. And even today, I can feel in some question of journalists the fact that Belle de Jour is something that people say I'm very related with, you know, as if I was, you know, partly, you know, very much that person.
What about Repulsion, though? I'm sure people always ask you about your character as a sexually repressed woman going mad.
She's a schizophrenic. Yeah, she's a schizophrenic girl, and she's. But Repulsion was very, very close to me in a way, because she was a very shy, very violent, deeply violent, but shy in the same time. And it's just because she was put in a certain kind of situation that sort of madness, you know, came out. Otherwise, you can imagine she could have followed very well for a very long time, living with her sister, probably getting married and having children, and nothing would have happened. Then, you know, there was something in her that went wrong, but because of the situation to be left alone for a weekend and her imagination, she had that little potential thing that became terrible, and she becomes, you know, what the film tells, you know, she becomes a criminal in the most violent way that... But also, I think in Repulsion, it's something I think people can identify with that woman. She's not a monster, you know. She's not doing that, you know, as a crude thing, just to be being cruel and wanted to kill. It's just something that she can't resist because she has fear of men, and she feels threatened.
In America, actresses start to feel shut out of films often by their mid-30s because they're no longer eligible for the glamour roles. Did you ever experience that in France?
No, because we are allowed to grow a little older in Europe, you know, not only in France, but in Europe. I think there is more attraction for a mature woman than there seems to be here, where everybody is so scared to get old and where people seem to be running so much after youth. Which, being an actress, you know, and growing up in age, you know, and in that profession, I can understand. But there is a sort of, to me, a foolish thing to try to escape in a wrong way, you know. I think you have to fight, you know, as much as you can and try to stay in shape. But if you run against what you are, I think you can really become crazy.
In America, I think a lot of actresses and actors as well feel that plastic surgery becomes essential to their career after a certain age.
It goes with it. It goes with it. You know, it goes with running against time. In Europe, it's the same, but to another level, I suppose. I suppose it's not as many people do it, and it's not as evident. But people do it to a more reasonable level, I have the impression.
Has that been an issue for you?
An issue for me, what?
Plastic surgery.
What means to be an issue?
I guess that's my very polite way of asking if you've done it yourself, which you don't need to answer if you don't want to.
You know, it's something I always refuse to answer because I had the impression that to say no was like saying to other women, what you think, I haven't done it. I think it's rude to... But now I think it's very difficult not to say that... You know, that started, you know, a few years ago. I started to be asked, and I say, I won't answer that because I find it rude, as if, you know, women who have done it were in another world. And I feel I sympathize very much for people, you know, who feel they have to do it. But today, I mean, the question comes back so often, I have to say that, no, I have to say I didn't do it. And I didn't do it because, like a lot of people, you know, I think I would be scared for the moment. But I must say that I'm very reluctant to answer to that question because I feel like saying, you know, I'm in one, that part of the woman, and there is the other part. I don't like this idea that the one who have done it, you know, it's like being a, come on, it's like a...
You don't want to be passing judgment on them by saying that you haven't done it.
Good. That's the way I should have put it.
Catherine Deneuve stars in the new film Thieves, Les Voleurs. It will be shown this weekend at the New York Film Festival and will open in movie theaters around the country in December. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music from Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai pas, ne parle pas, j'en mourrai. Je te cacherai et je te garderai. Mais mon amour ne me quitte pas.
Tu sais bien que ce n'est pas possible. Mon amour, faudra pourtant que je parte. Tu sauras que moi, je ne pense qu'à toi. Mais je sais que toi, tu m'attendras.
Deux ans.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Catherine Deneuve. Investigative reporters Donald Barlett and James Steele discuss the politics of taxes, and TV critic David Bianculli looks at The X-Files and Millennium.
Mon amour, oh mon amour,
Geneviève, ma petite Geneviève,
Guy, je t'aime. Tu sens l'essence?
C'est un parfum comme un autre.
Guy, je t'aime, oh Guy, je t'aime. Un client, je me sauve à 8 heures devant le théâtre.
parapluie.
Un parapluie. Où étais-tu? Là, en face. Êtes-vous fixé sur le genre d'article qui vous intéresse?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Catherine Deneuve. She stars in the new film Les Voleurs, Thieves, which will be shown this weekend at the New York Film Festival and will open in movie theaters around the country in December.
You've been working in the French film industry, well, in Europe, I should say, since the early 60s.
Yeah.
What are some of the ways you think the French film industry has changed since you started working? You started working in the days of the French New Wave, an incredibly exciting period to start.
Yes, but I mean, I didn't really... not really. It was almost they were starting to speak about the end, you know, of the new wave. So I was lucky enough, yes, to be involved more with young directors, you know, when I was quite young. So I didn't work with, you know, the old-fashioned directors. That was something very, very nice. But I don't have the impression. The thing that I have the impression is more than people don't go that much anymore to the movie, and so it's very difficult to go on making films, you know, to a certain level, because the audience, you know, prefer to wait for to see films on TV. And that's, you know, the major evolution I've seen in French cinema today. It's the less and less people go to the movie and younger people. So for a certain kind of film, it's very difficult to exist, except that we have an obligation on television to show a certain amount of films on television, which gives a relative... oxygen, you know, to French cinema. I don't know if it's right, because people say, you know, to be held that much, but in a way, you know, certain films are made that maybe that wouldn't be made otherwise if we didn't need so important quota of French films on television.
Do you think that men and women relate to you differently on screen?
Well, I hope so. I mean, yes, because there is a difference between men and women. You know, I don't think they see male and female actors on screen the same way. But I think women quite sympathize with me. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think women sort of resent me as a sort of icy, dangerous blonde. No, I don't think that.
You know, I'm wondering if women relate to you even more now than in the early part of your career, when you played more naive and very seductive women. Now there's a certain power that your characters have, or at least some of them have. The powerful characters have.
The powerful character that you can have, you know, that's the compensation of getting older, you know, is to have, you know, more mature parts with a character stronger and with more... but it's very difficult, it's true, for a young actress to find a very deep, very important, very touching, very warm, very very serious part. It's quite difficult to find everything in a part for a young actress, when you can think of a mature actress. I think there are certain age, you know, of life for an actress on screen. And there is the sort of what I was like in Ambulance of Cherbourg. You know, I was the young, romantic, idealistic girlfriend. Then there was, you know, the mature, younger, mature and responsible woman in Last Metro, film of France 1984. And there is today a touching woman that women can sympathize and identify with, because I don't represent, you know, a sort of glamorous in a sort of... artificial aware person. So it's the evolution of a life of an actress, I think.
You did Chanel perfume ads for years. How did you feel about doing those ads?
Very well. I liked it very much. I'd worked with them, and I was very I sympathize very much with the people. I think that if you do publicity as I did, you know, it's not something I do just to sort of hide it and put it away as if it was something I do on the side. It's really something I like, publicity, and I did enjoy very much to work with Avedon when we did that commercial for a few years, and I worked with the people who were writing the script. I felt very confident with that.
And
something I like very much.
Do you still wear perfume?
Do I wear perfume?
Yeah.
Yes, of course I wear perfume every day, even in the country.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it give you pleasure to wear it?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure it gives pleasure to others, but it gives me pleasure first at me to me as well.
I have one last question for you. I know your younger sister died when you were, I believe, in your 20s. Older sister, I'm sorry.
Yes, slightly older.
And I know you don't like talking about that, but I was just wondering one thing. If when you lost her, if it changed your life, if it made you think that life was so impermanent, if that changed the course, your course of direction, realizing...
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Deeply. Forever.
So how was the course of your life changed, do you think, or the direction that you took yourself?
I don't know what it would have been, you know, otherwise. What I know is that I will never, you know, forget the missing I have of her not being there. It's not something that, it's not that I had to learn to live, you know, without her, but I suppose it's like, it's an experience, you know, unhappily that people have to have in life. But as being as an actress, you know, and having children and but without the marriage and without having a sort of life as sort of as an actress, you know, like not being alone, but having, you know, quite big responsibilities. Very often I realized how much I missed her because, you know, we were doing the same thing, and I'm sure that would have found a very nice shoulder to talk to if she had been there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Catherine Deneuve stars in the new film Thieves, Les Voleurs. It will be shown this weekend at the New York Film Festival and will open in movie theaters around the country in December. Coming up, the politics of tax cuts. This is Fresh Air. Politicians love to make promises about tax cuts, but how much relief do tax cuts really bring to the middle class? Often, not as much as you'd think, according to Donald Barlett and James Steele. They're investigative reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their latest series, America, Who Stole the Dream, is being syndicated in many newspapers and will be published in book form later this month. In the presidential campaign, Bob Dole is promising a 15% tax cut and a 50% cut on capital gains tax. President Clinton has proposed a series of targeted tax breaks, up to a $10,000 tax deduction for college tuition, a $500 per child tax credit, and the elimination of the capital gains tax on home sales. Barlett and Steele examined the tax returns of Clinton and Dole and compared them with an average family in South Philadelphia.
When you look at the Doles, what we did was, and this is from their tax return, their total income was $648,617. Now, that included almost $65,000 in tax-exempt interest. We put that in because most middle-income families don't enjoy that kind of tax-free income. And when you do that and you look at just the effect of federal tax rate, for the Doles, it was 21%. For the Clintons, on a lot less money, interestingly, their total income was $322,000. Their effective federal tax rate was 23%, or actually 2 percentage points higher than the Doles. And the South Philadelphia family was 9%. So you look at it and you say, well, there is some progressivity there, but not very much. Then you add in Social Security and Medicare taxes, and now these numbers begin to shift. Now the Doles' overall federal tax rate is up to 23%. The Clintons are 25%. And the South Philadelphia families has jumped to 17%. Now you've further eroded that progressive nature. And then you add in the local state taxes. And then what happens is the Dole's overall tax rate is 29.6%. The Clintons, interestingly, are higher with about two-thirds less income at 31.5%. And that South Philadelphia family is 26.9%. So that South Philadelphia family is paying almost the same tax rate as the Doles, who have 18 times as much income.
What I'm hearing here is that there's a lot of very deceiving ways to figure out your taxes, and that if you just look at one piece of the picture, like federal tax, you really don't get an idea of how much you're actually being taxed.
You're absolutely right, because this is particularly true over the last 2 to 3 to 4 decades, where actually particularly over the last 2 decades, where so many programs have been shifted to the local level that were once funded by the federal government. By shifting them to the state and local level, that's put the burden on state and local governments to find ways to fund some of those. And this is where so much of the tax burden has soared in this country over the last few years. There's tremendous animosity about the tax system, and it's quite often directed at the federal government. But the fact is, where the increases have been so high and so heavy for middle-income families has been at the state and local level, because those tax rates almost everywhere have no progressivity in them at all. They hit people least afford to pay the most, whether they're sales taxes, real estate taxes, flat income taxes, personal property taxes. All of those things hit folks in medium income families far worse than folks at the upper rungs of the economic ladder.
And you look at just that effect of local tax rates, state and local taxes. For the Doles, it was 7%. Clinton, 6%. For that South Philadelphia family, it's 10%. So here's a family with an income of $37,000 paying out 10% in state and local taxes. The Doles with an income of $649,000 paying out 7% or 3 percentage points less.
So when we hear promise about how a federal tax rate is going to be cut, you have to look deeper than that to really understand how it's going to affect.
And it could actually be worse, because it means more programs are going to be transferred to state and local governments whose rates are going to go up higher, meaning less a further reduction in that top tax rate for wealthy people.
The one thing that also Washington never talks about as part of the tax system is Social Security and Medicare. But it is part of the tax system because it comes out of your paycheck, or if you're self-employed, you have to pay that. It's not an option, and it is a tax. In fact, the original legislation referred to it as a tax. One of the reasons that many in Washington disguise basically what's happening to federal tax rates is that they do not include that Social Security tax burden. All our computations always factor that in, and this is what's gone up so much.
You're arguing that the progressive tax system just barely exists anymore because the middle class are paying just about the same amount of taxes as the very wealthy, or the same percentage of taxes. When did the progressive tax system really start? What was the idea behind it?
The original idea behind the progressive tax system, and it dates really from the 19th century, was that you had vast pools of wealth that were going untaxed. People like the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, huge fortunes were accumulating. They were paying almost nothing for running the United States government, which had been very instrumental in helping those fortunes be built for a whole range of reasons. Most of the taxes were tariffs at the time, a duty collected on goods imported into the country, or in some cases exported. That funded most of the operation of the government. So the idea was to tap this huge pool of wealth. And the income tax in the region, and originally taxed just the very wealthy, just a tiny percentage of the people. It wasn't until World War II that it, in effect, was expanded to cover almost everyone. So the idea was the more you earned, the more you would pay. And despite the fact the income tax is out of favor by a lot of people, in the 1950s, which is when those tax rates were so high, was really the golden era for the creation of wealth in middle-class America. And you also saw, conversely, you did not see the great explosion in the rich then that you've seen in the last 15 to 20 years in this country, where tax rates have been much lower.
What's behind the leveling out of the tax rate system?
That's a really good question. This is one that transcends parties, because it really began with the Democrat, President Kennedy, when he wanted to lower the top rate, which was then about 90%. And as Jim indicated, this wasn't 90% of every dollar earned. It was 90% on taxable income above $400,000. And to put that in current terms, it would be about 2.3 million. So it would say that on your first 2.3 million, you get to keep most of it. But on everything above that, you would pay taxes at a 90% rate. And it was part of President Kennedy's tax package at that time to lower that top rate. And that's when it began. And basically, it began with a Democrat, President Kennedy, and it ended with Ronald Reagan, who pushed through the ultimate tax cuts in 1986, a Republican. So it transcends party labels, and it's a very strange mix of people who have supported this. And why, I don't think either one of us could answer that.
Why don't we look at what the president and presidential candidate Bob Dole have to say about taxes during this campaign. Bob Dole is asking for a 15% tax cut and a 50% cut in capital gains. I'd like you to analyze what that would mean.
Well, the 15% cut is probably part and parcel of so much of the philosophy over the last 15 to 20 years. Began so much in the Reagan years, but it was certainly embraced by many of the Democrats in Congress. The idea of cutting taxes is always irresistible as a kind of political carrot out there. Obviously, it's causing him some problems in his campaign because he's also been very much a deficit hawk. And I think sometimes people fail to realize how smart many average voters are out there on this issue. You can't have everything there. You can't start cutting taxes and also eliminating the deficit. So it's one of the reasons we think that that is not having the impact that it should. The other irony, and from Dole's standpoint about this cut, is that he was a prime mover back in the early 1980s toward putting in place the tax system for Social Security tax increases that is now hammering middle-class Americans so hard. So there's a real irony on that part. As far as the capital gains tax, that has been part and parcel of the agenda of many Republicans and Democrats in Congress for years and years and years. And the problem with it is that if you put that through, you would have then once again another dramatic tax reduction for a very small number of people. You know, people talk about capital gains, and you'll always hear this rhetoric that, well, this would benefit average people. You look at tax returns, and you see capital gains income is only taken on about 7% of tax returns filed each year. 7%.
What does President Clinton have to say about taxes?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure what he has to say about taxes. You know, this is fascinating from a Democratic standpoint. There are no defenders, or at least there are very few. There are some in Congress. This isn't true. There are some in Congress, but there are very few people who are outright advocates of the progressive income tax anymore. And it goes back to your original question, and I don't think either of us knows why this is the case. But even President Clinton, I think, has signed on to a capital gains tax rate cut. I think he wants some other things in return for it, but he would certainly sign it. And yet, in terms of fairness, there could be no more unfair tax in the country than that.
What suggestions would you have for us in how to interpret political promises on the local, state, or federal level about taxes?
Well, one of the first things you have to look for is that anytime they start using the word tax reform, watch out. That's the first thing, because invariably tax reform quite often does not work out to the benefit of the middle class. That was certainly true in the 1986 bill. And in fact, the first time you see the word tax reform used is by Andrew Mellon back in the 1920s, where he meant it as a reduction in the rates for those at the very top. It's one of the great ironies of our time, because you think of reform as making the system fairer, making it more equitable. The first thing people have to do, and this is what is so hard, they have to look as best they can as to how it would affect their own pocketbook. And interestingly enough, back in 1986, when the Tax Reform Act of that year was being debated and the press was uniformly endorsing it and saying, this is going to be great, this is going to simplify the system, this is going to make it fair, this is going to make it so that the rich who've been avoiding their taxes will pay their taxes. All of those debates, when all of them were going on, there were a number of public opinion polls taken that year across America. And invariably, average Americans were skeptical about these claims, as they should have been. They saw that the elimination of certain deductions, while not changing their basic rate much, might end up leading to a tax increase on their part, which is precisely what happened, particularly when Social Security taxes went into it. So there's no simple way. It's not an easy way. But you almost have to look at the claims to see, have I heard that before? and invariably you have.
There's also probably no other subject out there which is treated in a more misleading way by politicians. If you go back to that 86 Tax Reform Act, you would hear speech after speech, and you'd see it in the newspapers, magazines, radio, and television. No longer will Americans pay 72 cents on the dollar. That was the top tax rate. Nobody said that maybe one half of 1% of the population paid 72 cents on the dollar. The other 99.9% were totally unaffected by this. But you can imagine hearing this over and over and over again, the ordinary person thinks, my God, I'm paying 72 cents on the dollar. And, you know, nobody was ever close to that. Very, very misleading. And I think, as Jim indicated, the only way people can really be sure is when they hear a proposal, take out last year's tax return and sit down and figure out as best they can what it would look like. This is becoming increasingly more difficult for ordinary people to do. That's why we've always had one proposal out there that we think would solve the tax problem, and that is to pass a law that would require every member of Congress, under penalty of going to jail, to complete their own tax return. And if they were forced to do so, the tax system would become really simple and everyone could do it, because no member of, or very few members of Congress now prepare their own tax returns. IRS prepares them. It's a sort of a benefit for being a member of Congress.
What are some of the recommendations you've come up with for reforming the tax system?
Well, I think it goes back to what we talked about. It goes, eliminate all the deductions, every one of them, and just establish a system of a series of progressive rates. And no distinction between capital gain and ordinary income. All income should be treated alike. And if you did those two things, you could really, for most middle-income families, reduce the amount of tax. But I think, as we both Jim and I have indicated, unless you also deal with that Social Security system and the state and local taxes, for example, there needs to be some kind of a carrot and stick approach taken on the federal level in terms of revenue sharing. If the state government or the local government has a really regressive system, one that hits middle-income and lower-income people really hard, then they should get a smaller amount of the pie from the federal government, period. Those states and local governments that move toward a progressive system should be rewarded for doing so. And then that way, the overall tax burden would improve dramatically.
I want to thank you very, very much for coming back and talking with us.
Oh, our pleasure, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Donald Barlett and James Steele are investigative reporters at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their latest series, America, Who Stole the Dream?, is being syndicated in many newspapers and will be published in book form later this month. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on The X-Files and Millennium. This is Fresh Air. On television this month, The X-Files both reappears and relocates. The show presents its season premiere this week in its regular Friday time slot, then moves later this month to Sunday so that its Friday night spot can be filled by a new series called Millennium. Chris Carter, creator of The X-Files, is behind the new show as well. TV critic David Bianculli has seen them both.
Have you noticed how many series are trying to act like The X-Files this year? It's almost as bad as last season when every sitcom wanted to be like Friends. There's Dark Skies, a dumb period drama about aliens invading America in the 60s, and they're not talking about the Beatles. There's The Pretender, about a devious secret agent chased by members of an even more secret organization. There's Profiler, about a woman with psychic powers who solves violent crimes. And all those new shows are on one night, Saturday, on the same network, NBC. Elsewhere, the X-Files' influence can be felt as far away as the beaches of Baywatch, where the syndicated spinoff Baywatch Nights has redesigned itself this season to include, no kidding, UFOs and vampires. Not one of these shows gets it, though. All of them think there's nothing more to creating a scary TV series than putting the central characters in a dark room and handing them flashlights. But it's a lot more than that. It's about creating a sense of mystery and credibility and characters you care about. Chris Carter, creator of The X-Files and the upcoming Millennium series, is terrific at all of it. In the season premiere of The X-Files, David Duchovny, as FBI agent Fox Mulder, is getting even closer to the truth he knows is out there. His search for extraterrestrials has become like Ahab's search for the great white whale, an all-consuming obsession. In this episode, in the presence of a mysterious man played by Roy Thinnes, Mulder is closer than ever before.
Or you can stop it.
How can I stop?
I can take you to a place, show you the work in progress, where you can see your sister.
In Millennium, there's a hero who's even more driven than Mulder. Lance Henriksen plays an ex-cop, Frank Black, who's just like the woman in Profiler. Partly psychic, very reluctant to get involved, but too good not to help out when the bad guys get too evil. Frank Black, though, is a much deeper and more haunted character. In this scene, Frank visits the police morgue, and without so much as zipping open the victim's body bag, begins describing the condition of the corpse with uncanny accuracy.
He severed her head.
No mean task, let me tell you.
What was the position of the body when they found her?
She was on her back with her arms crossed over her chest.
You didn't find the murder weapon, but it was something he took from the crime scene.
Carving knife was missing from a kitchen set.
She was clothed. There was no evidence of sexual assault.
What else?
He cut off her fingers.
The man with the X-ray eyes.
What did hair and fiber turn up?
Maybe you should tell me. Two head hairs from a black male.
How's he do that?
I don't know. Lucky guesser.
Both Millennium and The X-Files have bigger things in mind than just creeping out viewers. In Millennium, the idea is that the evil in this world is escalating for a reason and by design, and that a secret organization has gotten together to fight it. In The X-Files, the idea is that when it comes to alien visitations, the truth is out there, and parts of the government have gotten together to suppress it. The real truth, though, is that Chris Carter no longer is responsible for one of the best and darkest dramas on TV. Beginning later this month with the October 25th premiere of Millennium, he's responsible for two of them.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Louisa Shafia. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with the madman of Latin music, pianist Eddie Palmieri. He's been a leading musician on the salsa scene for over 25 years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.